Renegade Health Radio.
Renegade Health Radio. We're here live.
Our first live show, yeah.
You guys are like, what does that mean? You're like, this is a podcast. We are actually in studio here at the Renegade Health office.
What's to you is kind of a big word. You know, Kevin has like a microphone set up on the desk. We're trying to get as close as possible to the microphone without it being completely awkward.
our knees are touching. Awesome. We're drinking a special tea here that I've actually not told Frederick what it is. He just trusted me to be able to just concoct it for him. But instead of just having one tea bag in a cup of tea, I really like getting creative and experimenting. So, for instance, today Frederick has the I Can Do It tea, and the I Can Do It tea is a very special Renegade Health blend, and it is one bag of green tea, one bag of coca tea, and one bag of holy basil tea. So what this does for you, there's three things that it does for you. One, it gives you a little caffeine with the green tea, gives you some antioxidants. There's antioxidants throughout the whole thing. Two, with the coca, it makes you gives you better brain aptitude, and if you happen to be in high altitudes, it's good for you, but we're at like 37 feet above sea level here in Berkeley, so it's not that, you know. And then Tulsi is relaxation, so it almost just kind of, it's almost in perfect harmony with the green tea, so it's giving you a little bit of relaxation with a little bit of an I can do it kind of mentality.
So Kevin, is this the equivalent of like coffee and Bailey's?
No. not even close. Do you feel like you can do it today, though?
Yeah, I can totally do it. Yeah.
If you guys do the mixture at home, just make sure that you take out the green tea early, Frederick reminded me, or else it'll get too bitter. So we're here. We have two things to talk about today. Do you want to let them know what we're going to talk about today? And
yeah, maybe tease them a second? First, why am I here? Because as you might know, I live in Montreal, Canada, and Kevin lives in beautiful, sunny Berkeley, California. So I try to come over once in a while, you know, to talk business. But this weekend there was a seminar that I attended. It's called the McDougall Advanced Study Weekend. So it's a seminar organized by John McDougall from the, you know, McDougall program, books and diet, etc. And he organizes this webinar twice a this seminar, but you can also watch it online as a webinar.
Oh, cool.
Twice a year. And it's a study weekend of speakers. So some of them are mostly about the plant-based nutrition kind of aspect, but also bringing in, you know, he's really good at bringing really awesome doctors, researchers. Last time he had Richard Wrangham, who wrote Catching Fire from Harvard University, you know, talking about, he has anthropologists, he has all kinds of people talking about different issues. So this year there was T. Colin Campbell from the China Studies stuff, Dr. Esselstyn. So these two men brought in a lot of people because they're popular in plant-based movements. So Esselstyn is a cardiologist who reverses heart disease through diet. And he had other speakers that I didn't know. James Hill is a doctor who works in Colorado for a weight loss center. So he talked about all the latest research on weight. He had Marlon Zook, which we can talk about today. She's an anthropologist who wrote a book called Paleo Fantasy. And we'll talk about, maybe that could be one of the topics for today. So it was a really interesting conference. I like to go there because, you know, you get challenged with new ideas. You know, you meet interesting people and so on. And of all the conferences I've been to, this is the one that's, I would say, at the highest level in terms of, you know, the quality of speakers they're bringing in. And it's, you know, you're really like, yeah, really advanced, not necessarily advanced, but people that have definitely published, you know, scientific papers and so on.
Yeah. What's the website that someone could go to?
Can go to Dr. McDougall, I think it's drmcdougall.com, drmcdougall.com, and he's got a link for his events. So there's another one coming up in September. But you can, I think you can watch it online for $150,
okay,
which is very
worth
affordable.
It.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Very cool. Yeah, that sounds great. I didn't even think to like go up and it's in Santa Rosa. It's like an hour from here. I didn't even think to go up there. But Emery was away for the weekend. She was hanging out with some fun people in San Diego. So before we get into the paleo fantasy, I do want to talk about the other thing we were talking about before, because I think this is a really interesting topic, because it's actually something I haven't really thought of before until you mentioned it. And now that you mentioned, Frederick just mentioned it to me like, I don't know, 30 minutes ago, but my mind has actually been consumed by it for the last 30 minutes trying to think about it. So
let's talk about it.
Yeah. All right.
So during a panel discussion on Saturday night at the conference, the topic came up on what is a natural death, and what is a natural lifespan for humans? Because the question was asked in this way: okay, so if we eat in a manner that doesn't cause heart disease and probably will prevent most cancers, maybe not all of them, so what do people on this diet die of? You know, because we're all going to die of something. So if you're not dying of a disease that is preventable, so what is a natural death? What is you know, naturally going to happen? And I'm going to answer that question based on what I learned at the seminar. But you know, I think the bigger discussion is something that I've seen a lot in natural movements, raw foods, and so on. Is people seem to think that we're somewhat invincible. You know, yeah. That we're never going to die. And when somebody dies, let's say at a relatively not so old age, like 72 years old, the question immediately is, you know, why did he die? Why did that person die? And you know, it never occurs to most people that, well, maybe it was just his time to go. You know, because the body eventually fails, and everybody's got a different lifespan.
Yeah, and who knows if the diet didn't actually allow the person to live 10 more years. So maybe their genetics, or essentially their genetics, when they're eating, say, a poor diet, would have said, hey, they're going to die at 62, but then they live another 10 years because they're eating a diet that's suited for their genetics, and they live to be 72. You know, people like us look at it and say, oh, it's a failure. You know, the health expert died at 72, but what if they were supposed to die at 62 or something like that, you know? So I don't know. But how are we supposed to die? Because, you know, for me, I don't even know. I haven't even thought about that. I mean, I imagine back before, you know, we were kind of keeping stats on this, people would maybe fall off a cliff or, you know, cut their foot and get an infection or, you know, but how do you die from old age? You know, what's the natural way to go?
So I'll put you in context, because it was kind of fun.
That's how we're going to die. Yeah. This is how we're going to die, right? I mean, whatever Fred's talking about is how it's going to happen for us. And you too, because you're eating a great diet, right?
Exactly. So in a conference, you know, there's John McDougall, there was Dr. T. Colin Campbell, there was Dr. Esselstyn, and the panel was moderated by John McDougall's son, who's about 30-something years old. So we've never seen him on this stage before. He's a doctor and works in Oregon. So the question was asked. And just prior to that question, the topic came up that Dr. Esselstyn is 80 years old now. And, looking quite good for his age and so on. So, and T. Colin Campbell is 79, you know, just a few months younger than Dr. Esselstyn. So, you know, they look pretty good for their age and so on. So that came up, you know. And then the question came up, you know, what is a natural death? And then John McDougall goes on and just says, okay, so here's what I think. It's the heart muscle eventually fails because it's been used, and the natural lifespan of human is 85 years old. So then there's that kind of odd silence and laughter, because we're all, you know, and Dr. Esselstyn later makes a joke about it. Yeah, while I'm busy dying of a heart failure, you guys are going to take over this movement or something. But anyway, so John McDougall explained that his theory is the heart failure theory. So the heart muscle weakens and then eventually fails, and you die in your sleep, and it just, you know, blood fills up the cavities in that area. It's pretty peaceful death. So he said that's
the blood filling up my cavities doesn't really seem peaceful.
Well, yeah, but, you know, it's better than most pets, I guess. And if it happens while you're sleeping, it's pretty good. And then Dr. Esselstyn said he's more of another school of thought, which is the immune system failing. You know, so the example he gave was Jack LaLanne, who died at 93. How did he die? He had a heart surgery, not for heart disease, you know, for maybe his heart was getting bad or something, but it's not like heart disease in the sense that his arteries were not obstructed. But he had the surgery, and then, you know, he got pneumonia shortly after. I mean, the body is just weak at that age.
Mm-hmm.
So one of those, the idea is one of those two systems, the immune system or, you know, the cardiovascular system will eventually fail. And that's how humans are supposed to die. So what is a natural lifespan? I guess natural lifespan is around 85 years old, which means some people are going to die older, right?
But that's a natural modern lifespan.
Modern, yes. Yeah. Maybe not, you know, in ancient times. But people, even in those days, you know, a lot of people reached relatively old age. So
it's an average thing, though.
Yeah, but yeah. You, I mean, rarely do you see people living beyond, you know, 95. I mean, occasionally you have people living in, you know, 100 years old. But I've been around this movement a lot for a while. And I mean, I follow kind of people dying that are raw foodists and so on. And I mean, they have an average lifespan, you know. But I think it's quality of life that matters most. What do you think, Evan?
I totally agree. You know, I always think about, you know, all these stories about so-and-so dying young, Herbert Shelton, and, you know, all these. Or no, Herbert Shelton, wasn't he, who was like, incapacitated for, like,
Herbert Shelton had, Parkinson's disease.
Yeah.
You know, who knows what caused it? I don't think it's the diet, necessarily.
Yeah. And then our, you know, he was a friend of Renegade Health, Andreas Moritz, died of just some complications from some illness that he had, you know, in the past, and relatively young. I think he was in his 60s. So, you know, you look at this, and again, the first thing that, you know, even if you go to the websites, you know, kind of all the popular health websites, you see people, like, asking, like, oh, what did he die from? You know, then suddenly they blame it on that, you know, he didn't eat enough fruit, or he didn't, you know, take the right supplements.
You know, people don't die of nutritional deficiencies, generally. I mean,
I agree.
They tend to die of excess, you know, much more in our society. I mean, I'm talking in our society, not, you know, in the third world or something. But when you reach that age, I mean, you're not dying of a B12 deficiency in most cases, or something like that. You know, most people who died, you know, died of a natural cause like this. I mean, my mentor, one of my first mentors from France, Dr. Moisseri, you know, when I was first getting started, I read a lot of his books. I was in correspondence with him for a long time. He died recently. He was around 86 years old.
Yeah.
And apparently died in his sleep, you know, of heart failure. So exactly in line with what John McDougall was saying in the weekend. So, you know, some people die. Of course, you know, you get some examples like Nathan Pritikin died of leukemia. But he got, you know, he died at around 70, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But his leukemia was diagnosed before, you know, he went on these diets. And so I think you could argue, you know, he had heart disease, and then he cured his heart disease through diet. And an autopsy revealed that he was largely free of heart disease when he died, but he died of some people say he committed suicide, but it was, you know, related to the pain caused by leukemia.
Okay.
But he was diagnosed before. So, you know, you never know how long someone would live, you know, if they've not done these diet changes. And I think we tend to generalize that a diet change will make us live forever. Everybody will reach a very, very high lifespan.
150, right?
150. You know what the theory is?
You got to have some friends, though. I mean, you got to have some friends who are on it, too. Because here's the thing. Like, if you live to 150 and you outlive everyone, even your kids, I mean, what kind of life, what's your quality of life? I mean, it's almost, I mean, I guess you could be like the 150-year-old, like, famous guy. Or, you know, but I mean, it's just, I don't know. It, to me, quality of life is so important. And I also think, you know, on the side of moderation in terms of diet, when you're a neurotic eater like I used to be. I mean, I'm sure that you were the same way, Fred. You know, just always thinking about that next meal, always thinking about, is it going to be organic? Is it going to be raw? Which, when I was a raw vegan, is it going to be vegan? Again, I still have a lot of these thoughts, but it doesn't consume me in the same way that it used to when I felt that that was the only type of diet that I needed. And the stress levels that were there then compared to what is now, I mean, it's a night and day difference. And I'm sure that stress. So if you were to take, I don't know, let's see, maybe a small piece of cake, and you were to eat a small piece of cake, and you were to feel the way that your body feels after you eat a small piece of cake, I mean, you might get a little sugar rush. Or you were to take the feeling that you get just about every day, all day, when you're stressed about what kind of food you're going to eat next as a health foodie or an orthorexic type person. That stress energy that you feel is so much more powerful than that sugar energy. And that to me is telling me on a very basic level that something is happening in the body that is bad and you have to get rid of it. And I think that is more damaging than having an occasional piece of cake. Not that I eat cake, but, you know, just saying that, you know, maybe I'd have a piece of cake if you offered me a piece of cake, Fred. But do you have a piece of cake?
No, but I could probably produce one. yeah, I think you're onto something, because it comes back to the idea that diet will prevent a lot of diseases, right? But yeah, it's not going to prevent ultimately your demise. And your lifespan is fixed probably by your genes, or your maximum lifespan, let's say. So, you know, there are a lot of things that will affect your quality of life, and stress is one of them, and just being extremely neurotic about food is definitely going to affect your quality of life. Just as, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe not as much as being an overeater constantly, you know, eats the wrong foods, but it will definitely affect you.
Yeah. All right, let's move into diet. Let's move into the paleo fantasy.
All right, so this comes again from this last weekend seminar. So we want to kind of give you up-to-date research and knowledge.
What is a paleo fantasy? Is it like tell me just what, like, is it someone fantasizing about eating, you know, bone broth, or?
I think that, well, first of all, let's put it in context. Marlene Zook is an anthropologist. She wrote a book called Paleo Fantasy, right? So she's a PhD researcher. I didn't read the book, I must say, because I just saw her presentation. She gave a one-hour presentation, but this is a topic.
Come prepared, man.
This is a topic that I will read the book, definitely. This is a topic that's been around, especially in, you know, raw food worlds. Why? Because, first of all, you hear, on the one hand, you hear the fruitarian saying, you know, we should eat a fruit diet because our human ancestors or pre-human ancestors ate a fruit diet, a fruit-based diet, and the chimpanzees eat fruit diet, and so on. So we should eat a fruit-based diet. And then, on the other hand, you have the paleo diet people who say, well, grains are new, you know, you shouldn't eat any grains because they've only been around for 10,000 years. The body, you know, has then adapted to them. So, and our ancestors ate plenty of animal protein, so we should eat a diet of animal protein, some fruit, vegetables, and so on. I think the problem is that we're all looking at the past as a justification for a diet, mm-hmm, in the present. So, you know, before we even talk about what Marlene Zook talked about in her seminar, well, I never thought that was true, because the past is the past, you know. The challenges and the circumstances were way different back then. And right now, if we're trying to find the appropriate diet for us, it might not have much to do with what people ate in the past, you know, because we ate to survive, and the primary concern back then was getting enough calories. So we're kind of programmed, you know, this is something you've probably heard about, is that right now we have a problem because our genes are adapted to an environment that is no longer our environment. So our genes are adapted to an environment where food is not abundant.
Mm-hmm.
And exercise is a part of life because you have to exercise to get food. So your motivation in your genes are to be lazy because it pays off to be lazy. You know, if you live 100,000 years ago,
mm-hmm.
you want to rest as much as possible when you get a chance because you often don't get a chance to rest. And you also want to consume high fat, high calorie, dense foods when you find them because those foods are not around very much. So we have a drive to consume these foods because, you know, it's written in our genes. Hey, these foods, you know, if you eat them, you're going to survive because they're not, you know, they don't come around very often. So now we live in an environment that's a mismatch. Also psychologically, at many levels, our environment is just, you know, we haven't had time to evolve and adapt. So we have a problem. So what's the solution? Is it to go back to, you know, to the primal ancestors and what they ate?
But
what do you think, Kevin, before we jump into, you know, what Mrs. Zook?
Well, I mean, I just never, you know, I every time I go back and I watch the videos when I was talking about why the raw food diet is the best diet for anyone on the planet, I kind of, you know, put my head in the ground and just like an ostrich, you know, I'm like, oh my gosh, like, I don't know if that's true anymore. And so for me, I just, any kind of looking back into the past to me in terms of diet, just, it just, to me now at least, it doesn't make that much sense to me. I don't think, I mean, I don't know what I'm talking about.
But you don't think it's right.
I don't think it's right. That's what it comes down to.
I used to think in terms of, well, it's not true. Like, I would, you know, look at the past and say, and think humans didn't eat a fruitarian diet, and they also didn't eat a diet rich in animal foods necessarily. Maybe some of them did. But now I think that it actually doesn't matter what they ate, because likely human beings in different parts of the world ate a different diet based on their environment. And as far as your genes are concerned, it doesn't matter if you die of disease. You know, as long as you get to pass on your genes, that's what truly matters in a sense. So
heartless.
It is, but, you know, that's how it works, because those genes are around because they've been passed along, you know, generation after generation. So as long as they're passed. So what Marlin Zook talked about was that evolution is just is not perfect. People think, hey, we have kind of reached the pinnacle of evolution in the human being, but it just has to be good enough. And the example was that everything is a trade-off. So there's an insect that lives on a leaf, and it looks a lot like the leaf. So it's a camouflage system. But in order to look like the leaf, it has to be green and have little black dots, because the leaf has these black dots too. It turns out that in order to make these black dots, it kind of reduces its immune function. I think it's the same, I don't know, pigment that's used, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know exactly the scientific reason, but what I know is it's a trade-off. So the creature wants to look like leaf. Actually, it doesn't even want, it just happens automatically, because the ones that look like the leaf end up surviving, you know, but it's a trade-off because it's giving up something.
Mm-hmm. So doesn't want to look like a disco ball.
Exactly. So it's also, for us, it's also a trade-off, right? Everything is a trade-off. If you look at the human being, the way we're constructed, it's pretty much a mismatch of, you know, it's a compilation of all the genes that survived, you know, from different creatures. And it's not created by, you know, sorry for anybody, if I offend anybody with more religious tendencies, but it's really not created by an engineer. It's more, it just turns out to be, I don't know, I don't remember exactly what she said, but in terms of, she had like a quote about, you know, an engineer wouldn't come up with that because
the engineer would be more efficient.
Well,
number one,
he would decide in advance, you know, you want to build a bridge, what pieces do you need? But in our case, in the cases of creatures around, you know, on the planet, it's more like what's available in the environment, and we're going to kind of, you know, make a bridge out of stuff that, you know, is all over the place. And that's how the body is created. So it's not perfect. You know, the human body is not perfect. No creature is perfect on the planet, but it doesn't have to be perfect. We don't have to be perfect. We just have to be good enough to survive and pass on our genes. So,
and resourceful too. I mean, the interesting thing is if you look at all the systems, you know, you kind of look at, you can do a scan of the systems in the body and say, if you have, you're overtaxing your adrenals, right? So you're stressing out and your sex hormones are dropping, but your body is still trying to pull all the resources it can to not only support your adrenals, but also continue to do all the functions of your body. So it's always trying to like pull itself into balance, and it's probably, and I don't believe it's ever in balance, right? But it's always like, it's always this play of making sure that it's getting just close enough to balance for you to thrive. I mean, at least, you know, that's kind of how I see it. And so I like the way that it's portrayed here, because that makes total sense. It's not perfect enough to be designed by an engineer in that way. The engineer is much more calculated, I guess. But it's amazing all at the same time.
It's amazing that it's amazing. I mean, we share genes with bacteria.
Yeah.
You know, we have genes that are so ancient. It's it boggles the mind.
Well, I'm 2.9% Neanderthal.
You're
so only 22% of the people on this planet have more Neanderthal than me, and you can tell.
That's your hair.
Fred and I took the 23andMe test. So
DNA testing.
DNA testing. Yeah. Yeah,
it just gave us the truth that we're just two white guys, pretty much. Oh, you're 99.3% European. Oh, really? I wanted something exciting.
I know.
But yeah, so one thing that was discussed also is the fact that evolution can happen pretty fast. You know, so it's not true to say that we haven't adapted since agriculture has been around, because one example is the lactase persistence gene, which is a gene that probably many of our listeners have. If you're from a European descent, you might probably have this gene, which makes it that you can digest lactose in milk. So we didn't have this gene before.
You know, but just not the hormones. Just not the hormones that they pump into regular milk.
It doesn't mean that it makes milk good for you, but it means you can use it as a source of nourishment.
Sure.
And so if people who had this gene long time ago were more likely to survive because they could get this alternative source of nutrition, that means the gene got passed along. And it only takes about 30 generations for a gene to be widespread in a population when it gives only a slight, like 2 or 3% survival advantage. So it can happen really fast. Mm-hmm. Also, another example is the enzyme we make to break down starch, which is called amylase. So it's more prevalent in areas of the world that have more of a past of cultivating grains. So, you know, hunter-gatherers or, you know, maybe the natives of Australia don't have as many copies of this gene. They do still have it, but not as many as, let's say, an Asian person who's been eating rice for 10,000 years. So that's, you know, that's the thing. It's, we can't say that we haven't adapted. We cannot say that we lived in perfect harmony before, and what worked then will work now, because it's not the case. You know, we live under different circumstances. What mattered before was survival. What matters today is thriving. Those are very different things. We don't face the same challenges. Now, the challenges that we have are regarding getting too much of food, you know, being overweight. And it's not the same, you know, those are not the same challenges. So I think that the optimal diet nowadays has something to do maybe with, you know, the fact that we should eat natural foods and so on, but nothing to do with what our ancestors necessarily ate, you know, 100,000 years ago. It doesn't matter. We have to find, with current evidence right now, what's healthy. That's all that matters.
I think that's great. I don't have anything else to say to that. Usually I have something to say. I'm good. I'm clear.
Well, I got an edge this week because I just attended a seminar, so I'm pretending to know all kinds of new information.
Fred will recant about 75% of what he says on next week's podcast.
I think it makes sense.
I do too. The gene stuff is great. I mean, now that we can look at genes, I mean, obviously what happens though still is that you run the risk of going too far and looking at something like it is the definitive way to look at things. Like, you know, you could do it with diet, you can do it with managing your stress, you can do it with just anything. I mean, even science, you can say, oh, well, you know, creationism, or you can say, you know, theology, or you can, you know, like you, once you go so far one way and essentially ignoring all the other factors around, then it can become a problem. I think gene study is probably going to be the same way, where you just use it as a tool, as you use blood testing, as you use how you feel, as you use, you know, maybe meridian point tapping, EFT, as you use all these tools to kind of create your perfect balance in terms of your own life, your own health, the motivations that you have personally and the things that you're able to do, all those combined together, that's your real science, right? Not just, you know, just looking at one thing or the other. But I think what this gene stuff adds is that there is a little bit of a little kernel of definitiveness in some way, where we can look back at our genes and say, oh, wait, I can actually digest lactose. But that doesn't mean that you might be able to eat, you know, hormone-ridden, you know, conventional cow's milk or cheese, or go to McDonald's and have a cheeseburger, if there's even cheese in that stuff. But it does mean that you might be more suitable to doing that. And what it also means is that you're different than the next person. So when expert A goes up on stage and tells you that you should never eat salt or never eat this or that, well, you know, look at that with a grain of sea salt and say, hey, you know, maybe they're just doing this because it's their experience and what they found has worked for them based on their genetics, based on their personal experience, based on their health histories. And it may work for you, or it may completely take you in the wrong direction.
I just want to say one final thing. I got an idea.
Okay.
From what you were saying, and it's...
I smell burning.
You mentioned, you know, we're all different, and this is something that came up in during the weekend for me. You know, thinking about a gene becomes prevalent in a population because there was initially a few individuals with a mutation. You know, so a few odd people had, you know, an odd gene, for example, for digesting lactose, and that gave them an advantage. A survival advantage, so that gene became prevalent. So there's all kinds of genes. There's some that are not so good, right?
Mm-hmm.
As well, that are all over the place. And so if you feel there's something, you know, that is truly unique about you, for example, maybe you're not handling caffeine very well, and everybody tells you, well, you should be. It's just, you know, half a cup of coffee, and you know what could possibly happen, because they don't have any problems with it, but maybe you have something in your body, a gene that just doesn't handle, you know, makes it that you don't handle caffeine very well, or not very, you know, nobody will be able to identify this with precision, but you can tell with your own feedback system. So I think there's a diet, there's general principles that pretty much apply to everybody. But the small things like that, I think, are truly unique, you know, and you got to find it out for yourself.
I agree. Find it out for yourself, guys. This is Renegade Health Radio, Frederick Patnod, Kevin Gianni.
Thank you.
Bye.
Renegade Health Radio.